Hello, I'm Dr. Albert Rizzo, Chief Medical Officer of the American Lung Association. Welcome to LungCast. As we continue to highlight milestones and celebrities in pulmonary history, it is appropriate for today's segment to be in the area of tuberculosis, because each March 24 is marked as World TB Day. Tuberculosis has very ancient origins and has likely been around for over 70,000 years, and it currently infects nearly 2 billion people worldwide, with around 10.4 million new cases of TB each year. Almost one-third of the world's population are carriers of the TB bacillus and are at risk for developing active disease. TB has always been associated with high mortality rate over the centuries and is estimated to be responsible for 1.4 million TB deaths worldwide in 2019. In historical terms, tuberculosis was the greatest killer ever known to mankind. Accounts of tuberculosis were found in the writings of ancient Egyptians and in those of Hippocrates. And it was called the captain of all these men of death by English writer John Bunyan. At its peak in the United States, it killed one in every four people. It was often called consumption because its victims just wasted away. On March 24, 1882, Dr. Robert Koch announced the discovery of Mycobacterium tuberculosis, the bacteria that causes TB. During his time, TB killed one out of every seven people living in the United States and Europe. Dr. Koch's discovery was the most important step taken toward the control and elimination of this deadly disease, and for that reason, a century later, March 24 was designated World TB Day, a day to educate the public about the impact of tuberculosis around the world. The efforts to advance the science around tuberculosis planted the seeds of what became the modern American Lung Association. On June 6, 1904, a group of people, both lay and professional, concerned about the raging epidemic of tuberculosis, inaugurated the National Association for the Study and Prevention of Tuberculosis, an effort spearheaded by Dr. Edward Livingston Trudeau. This organization had a number of formal name changes, but ultimately evolved into the American Lung Association in 1974. Trudeau, who was diagnosed in 1873 with tuberculosis himself, was also a major proponent of the sanatorium philosophy of tuberculosis management. He had spent his time recovering from tuberculosis in upstate New York. In 1882, he read about Dr. Herman Brehmer's success treating tuberculosis with what was called the rest cure in cold, clear mountain air in Europe. This led to him opening a sanatorium in this country called Adirondack Cottage Sanatorium in Saranac, New York, in 1884. Later in 1894, Trudeau built the first laboratory in the United States for the research of tuberculosis. He later died from TB disease in 1915. Isolating people and proper nutrition was the best TB treatment before antibiotics were developed later in the century. TB sanatoriums were places that provided treatment for TB patients and took the patients out of their home, which reduced the chance to spread tuberculosis to their family members. Patients were treated for TB with fresh air, good food, and at times surgery. Many sanatoriums relied on philanthropy to survive and fulfill their mission. The Delaware Anti-Tuberculosis Society had built a sanatorium where tuberculosis patients could rest and recover on the Brandywine River. But before long, funds were running low. A Danish-born American social reformer, Jacob Riis, had started Christmas seals added to holiday mail, which were used in Denmark to raise money to combat tuberculosis in children. Inspired by this idea, the first Christmas seal in this country went on sale for 1 cent at Delaware post offices on December 7, 1907. The seals raised $25 on the first day, but the sales quickly slowed down. Thanks to effort from local philanthropists, a Philadelphia newspaper, called the North American, began selling the seals in their lobby. They also began running daily articles under the heading Stamp Out Tuberculosis. Soon, President Theodore Roosevelt learned of the campaign and offered his support, further bringing attention to it. By the end of the year, Christmas Seals had raised $3,000, 10 times the amount of money needed to save the sanatorium on the banks of the Brandywine River. Christmas Seals continued to be used to raise funds to promote lung health and prevent lung disease. In 1987, the American Lung Association acquired a trademark for the term Christmas Seals to protect their right to be the sole U.S. national fundraising organization to use them. Other important dates in tuberculosis history include 1970, when the Robert Koch Medal was established and awarded on an annual basis for excellence in the biomedical sciences. In 1926, the Edward Livingston Trudeau Medal was established and awarded to an individual with lifelong major contributions to the prevention, diagnosis, and treatment of lung disease through leadership and research, education, or clinical care. And as part of the Distinguished American Series, he was also honored with a U.S. Postal Stamp in 2008. In recognition of World TB Day and the efforts to raise awareness around tuberculosis, it is more than fitting that this month's podcast brings an update on the status of tuberculosis in this country and offers highlights and guidance for clinicians when suspecting, diagnosing, and understanding recommended treatments for tuberculosis, whether latent or active disease. To do this, we are fortunate to have with us today Dr. Philip LeBoux, Director of the Division of Tuberculosis Elimination in CDC's National Center for HIV, AIDS, Viral Hepatitis, STD, and TB Prevention. Dr. LeBoux earned his undergraduate and medical degree from the University of Pennsylvania and completed his pulmonary and critical care fellowship in 1995 at the University of California, San Diego Medical Center. He is board certified in pulmonary medicine and critical care medicine, and he has authored or co-authored over 70 scientific papers and book chapters, including many on the impact of new technologies and the changing epidemiology of tuberculosis. He is a member of the International Union Against Tuberculosis and Lung Disease, the American Thoracic Society, and several World Health Organization committees and working groups. Dr. LeBoux has been recognized for his leadership, receiving CDC's Award for Excellence in Surveillance and Health Monitoring, and the U.S. Food and Drug Administration's Award for Outstanding Service. At a time of designated reflection on a long fight against this respiratory disease, and amid our current work to lessen the burden of COVID-19 on our population, Dr. LeBoux's insights highlight how far we've come and how much more we can do to impact tuberculosis. We hope you enjoy. So Dr. LeBoux, my first question is to give our listeners some background. Often our careers are guided by experiences shared and importantly by colleagues and mentors we've met along the way. Could you share with us the trajectory of your career and what led you to be interested in tuberculosis and ultimately your role at the CDC?
Yes. Well, first, thank you for inviting me, and it's a pleasure to be here to speak with you today. So my interest goes back to my medical training, particularly my pulmonary fellowship at the University of California, San Diego. As part of the research I was doing, I was involved in a number of TB projects, mainly around diagnostics, some of the actually first studies of the interferon gamma release assays, nucleic acid amplification tests, and one of the first studies of rifapentine, which at the time was actually an experimental drug, a new drug. And as I became involved in those studies, I was very much working with the local TB program at the San Diego County Health Department and developed relationships there. And it just happened to be an opportunity that CDC was placing a medical officer in San Diego County in the TB program. And so I applied for that job because I became very interested in that work, got the job, worked there for about 5 years, and then got an opportunity to go to CDC headquarters in Atlanta as chief of their medical consultation team for TB, and did that for several years, and had another opportunity to become the associate director for science in the division, and then finally in 2014 became the division director.
Very good, very good. So let's get to the topic in general here. In the early 1900s, we know TB killed one out of every seven people living in the US and Europe at that time. Then in the 1940s, due to scientific discoveries, the first of several medicines now used to treat TB were discovered. As a result, TB slowly began to decrease in the United States. In 2019, TB cases and incident rates in the US still continue to decline, but TB remains an important public health problem because the rate of decline is inadequate to achieve one of our goals of TB elimination this century. Also of concern, the TB continues to disproportionately affect some US populations, particularly people from racial and ethnic minority groups. Dr. LeBeau, can you speak a bit more about the remaining burden of TB in this country and some of the reasons why?
Yes. You know, as you pointed out, really, we have had good progress since the 1990s with substantial amount of decreasing in cases and the case rates. In fact, cases were peaked, I think, in 1992 at a little over 26,000. And in 2019, we were down to 8,900 or so. But to reach elimination, we'd actually have to have only about 300 total cases in the United States. So there's still quite a ways to go. And in terms of, you know, where is the burden currently, it really goes back to how does one become infected with TB. To become infected, you have to be exposed to someone else who has pulmonary TB disease, because the disease is airborne and transmitted from person to person. So in the US now, that really comes down mainly to two groups of people. One is having been born, lived for a substantial period of time, or traveled in for a substantial period of time in countries where TB rates are much higher. So that's where someone would likely get exposed. Within the United States, it's really not usual for your average person to be exposed to TB because it's not common here. But there are settings where there's definitely a higher risk. We refer to those as congregate settings. And specifically, I'm talking about homeless shelters, for example, or correctional facilities, where there's definitely a higher risk of being exposed. So, in thinking about that, in terms of the people who were infected outside the US, more often than not, they are infected and they have the latent form of TB, and then they actually get sick, could be months, years, or even decades later. It's more common to see TB, we call kind of the rapid development of TB when the transmission is occurring in some of these congregate settings, and we see sometimes even outbreaks related to that.
That kind of feeds a little bit into my next question. The treatment of latent TB infection seems to be essential to really controlling TB in this country, because it really reduces the risk that latent TB infection will progress to the active TB disease. Without treatment, on average, the numbers are 1 in 10 people with latent TB will go on to develop active TB in their future. And it seems that more than 80% of people who get sick with TB in this country each year get sick from untreated latent TB. Reading through the CDC's websites, I understand that to accelerate progress towards elimination, the CDC supports what's called a dual approach that includes diagnosing and treating every case of TB disease and preventing future cases by expanding testing and treatment for people with latent TB infection. So in that regard, I think you touched on this already, but I'd also like to touch more on what is the role and how is the testing for latent TB managed in this country, and specifically touch on the role of the skin test or Tyne test versus the QuantiFERON blood test that is often used these days as well. And I think your background really points to that as something you can comment on.
As you said, because more than 80% of TB cases are occurring because of reactivation of latent tuberculosis, frequently that infection was acquired outside the U.S. Rather than recent transmission within the U.S., that testing and treatment for latent infection probably could have the biggest impact in kind of accelerating our goal of reaching elimination. And there are a number of groups that are recommended to have testing and treatment for latent TB, and number of guidelines or recommendations. One that we definitely support is that by the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, which that one particularly focuses on, as a group I've already mentioned, people who were born in a country with high TB rates or traveled there for some period of time or lived there for some period of time. And then the other group that I mentioned has to do with the congregate settings, homeless shelters, correctional facilities. So it's important that those people who are at risk get tested. And if they're positive on one of the tests you mentioned, which I'll talk a little bit about in more detail, if they're positive on one of those tests, that they be offered treatment, which can prevent them from getting to the active form of the disease where they would get sick. Because for when someone has latent TB infection, they don't have symptoms, they feel well, but they are at risk for getting sick. There's some other groups that are important too. And for one group, people who have conditions or, potentially HIV, for example, or other conditions which affect their immune system, which would make them more likely to get sick with TB if they were infected. The average person in the United States where they've probably heard about tuberculosis is those commercials for some of the biologics, for example, for arthritis, where they say, oh, if you're going to take this medicine, make sure you get tested for TB, because that's another example of a medication where it's suppressing your immune system and would put you more at risk. And transplant patients or some cancer treatments. So that those are other important groups. So in terms of the tests that are available, we have the tuberculin skin test. And that test involves an injection of a small amount of material called purified protein derivative, which comes from TB and basically looks for a person having an immune reaction. They get a bump in the skin where it's injected. That requires two visits because you have to get the material injected and then you have to come back and have that read, which is 2 or 3 days later. The second type of test is a blood test called an interferon gamma release assay, or IGRA. That's a blood test. In that case, blood samples taken, and then basically the person's blood is exposed to proteins from tuberculosis. And then you look for production of interferon gamma, which suggests that your body's immune cells have seen TB before, so you're infected, and now they're responding and producing this interferon gamma. So those are two tests. The advantage of the interferon gamma release assay, there are two main ones. One is it only requires one test when you get your blood draw, so you don't have to have two visits. The second one is that there is a vaccine called BCG vaccine, which is used in many parts. We don't use it in the US, but used in many, many countries. That vaccine is actually for tuberculosis. So you might ask, why don't we use it? Well, the reason why is because, number one, TB is not common in the US. But number two, the vaccine really isn't all that effective in preventing TB overall. What it is effective in doing is preventing bad forms of TB, such as meningitis or disseminated TB in children. So in places where there's lots of TB, it makes sense, but in low incidence country, it doesn't. The problem is that vaccine, because it involves a strain of bacteria that's very closely related to TB, can give a false positive reaction with the tuberculin skin test. And that is not seen with the blood test. So the blood test has that advantage. And so particularly in populations, people who are likely to have had the BCG vaccination, you're not going to see the potential false positives with interferon gamma release assays. So that's the advantage. The disadvantage is that in terms of cost, the actual cost of the interferon gamma release assay tends to be higher. Although if you actually look at all the costs involved, particularly if you're dealing with a population where you could get false positives from the BCG vaccine, the blood test tends to be cost effective, because if you start getting false positive tests, it makes you do extra things like getting chest x-rays or potentially treating people based on these false positives, which results in additional costs that actually then kind of counteract any savings you would have on the test itself.
That's a good explanation. One other thing on the skin test, there's often something called a booster phenomenon. Sometimes it's it leads to people having some unsure results. Can you just comment on that a little bit, what that is?
Yes. The booster phenomenon really occurs particularly in situations where people undergo what we call serial testing. So this tends to be more occupational-based testing. So particularly healthcare workers, where they, although we don't generally recommend this now, but in the past and some places continue to do it, is where we have healthcare workers who every year they're getting tested. And the concern is that if you were, if you are infected in the very distant past, over time, the reaction to the skin test may fade. So let's say you were a healthcare worker, you were infected 20 years ago, you apply for a new job, you haven't been tested recently, you come in and your test is negative, even though you actually were infected in the past. So then the next year goes by and you get tested, now you're positive. Well, the concern there is that, well, it looks like you've been infected recently because this happened within this year. Well, when that's not really what happened. What happened is you had the infection a long time ago, it faded. The first skin test you had on employment, just the exposure to that antigen, the PPD, boosted your immune response. And now you're actually seeing that happen a year later when you're tested again. That's the booster phenomenon. And what we recommend to avoid that from happening in people who undergo that type of testing is actually when they come in for that initial testing, let's say upon employment, is they actually get tested twice within, let's say, 10 days or so. So you get your first test, if it's negative, it gets done 10 days later, and now it's positive. Well, it's not really likely within the 10-day period in the United States you got exposed to TB again. Right. If it's positive in that setting, it means it's probably boosted. So that then we can say, oh, that looks like a boosting test, not like you got infected recently.
Right. Makes sense. And as you said, there's no real recommendation these days to be doing serial testing on a yearly basis in most healthcare settings.
Yeah, unless, you know, if for some reason there was, and we haven't seen this, generally don't see this very, very rarely, you know, that for some reason there's actually an outbreak associated with a healthcare setting or it looks like there's transmission occurring, which you mentioned, back in the 1990s when we actually did have the resurgence, that was actually happening where you had a substantial transmission in healthcare settings, but a lot of things were put into place that really reversed that. So it's not very common.
So I want to switch gears a little bit and go on to talk about some treatment. I know we're both members of the American Thoracic Society, and back in 2016, the ATS, along with the CDC and Infectious Disease Society of America, put out guidelines for treating drug-susceptible TB. Can you talk a little bit now about the medications and regimens available for treating latent and active TB in the United States today?
Yes. So for, let's start with latent TB. So latent TB is generally one or two drugs for a shorter period of time. So there are three recommended regimens for latent TB. The first one is 3 months of once weekly isoniazid plus rifapentine. So that's 12 total doses once a week. The second one would be 4 months of rifampin daily. And then the third one is 3 months of a combination of daily isoniazid and rifampin. So those are the regimens for latent TB, assuming we work on the assumption that the person was exposed to a drug susceptible form, unless there's reason to think otherwise, such as they were a close contact of someone with drug resistant TB. And those are also very effective, probably 90% effective. So then if you have TB disease, it's more complicated, which is why we recommend that people of latent TB take the preventive treatment, because if they get TB disease, then you're dealing with a more complicated regimen. And in that case, you have to, current regimen is 6 to 9 months. Most people can get away with 6 months, but it starts with four drugs. So isoniazid, rifampin, ethambutol and pyrazinamide for the first 2 months, and then for the remaining 4 months, isoniazid and rifampin. So one of the things that we're excited about is actually a potential now to decrease that treatment to 4 months. We recently conducted a study working with NIH, and this involved a new regimen that was 4 months long, in which we did a randomized trial and compared the standard 6 month regimen versus this new 4 month regimen, which the 4 month regimen includes isoniazid, rifapentine, pyrazinamide, and moxifloxacin. And that shorter 4 month regimen was just as good as a 6 month regimen in this study, which we're hoping will be published soon. And then after that, we will be looking to write guidance. So it may be possible now to treat many patients with drug susceptible TB for even a shorter regimen.
And my understanding is that, at least in this country, many treatments for TB are managed by public health departments on a state basis. Is that correct, or is that vary a lot from state to state?
Well, the state and local, or some combination of the above, are responsible for oversight of all TB treatment. It's a public health issue because it's transmissible from person to person. So they have a responsibility for oversight. How that treatment occurs varies. So there are some places where the local health department will pretty much manage and actually provide the direct medical care for TB patients. And there are other places where it's mainly done by private providers, although with help and oversight by the health department. And in some places, it's a hybrid. So, for example, when I was in San Diego, it was a hybrid. About two-thirds of the patients were treated by their regular private physicians with assistance and oversight by the health department. And one-third were actually treated in the county health department clinics.
And I guess depending on the population treated and the regimen, is there still directly observed therapy recommended in certain situations?
Yes, especially TB disease. There may be some instances where it's reasonable for high-risk persons, especially young children, in a household where directly observed therapy is, for example, being done for the parent who has TB disease, that they also get the child gets the latent TB treatment through directly observed therapy. But definitely for people with TB disease, directly observed therapy, meaning that a trained healthcare worker actually observes every dose of medication. And the reason for that is if all the doses of medication are not taken correctly, not only is there a good chance that the person will fail their treatment and not get better, but it puts them at great risk to develop drug-resistant TB, which is a lot more difficult to treat.
And that kind of fits right into my next question. I noticed back in 2015, there was a national action plan for combating multi-drug resistant TB. And it stated the goals of the plan were to strengthen the domestic capacity to combat MDR-TB, improve the international capacity and collaborate to combat MDR-TB, and to accelerate basic and applied research to develop and combat MDR-TB. And then the same organization that put out the recent guidelines we talked about in 2019, ATS, the CDC, and the Infectious Disease Society also published a guideline on drug-resistant TB therapy. Can you comment on the treatment of that group of individuals, especially in this country?
The treatment of drug-resistant TB, especially multi-drug-resistant TB, which is defined as resistant to the two best first-line drugs, isoniazid and rifampin, is definitely more difficult and has more side effects and takes longer. So typically, you're looking at a drug regimen of 4 to 6 drugs, 18 to 24 months, as opposed to 6 or now even potentially 4 for drug susceptible TB. That's expensive. Its average cost is somewhere around $158,000. Part of that is because often these patients will require hospitalization, which is very expensive. So it's best, if at all possible, to avoid getting to the point where you have to deal with drug-resistant TB. But if someone does, then this is the way they have to be treated. And as I said, it's more complicated, more adverse events, longer, more expensive. Now, there have definitely been some progress made previously in the prior guidelines, the ones before the recent ones, that you mentioned, one of the mainstays of treatment were injectable drugs. So people had to either get intramuscular, intravenous injections as one of the main drugs for treating multidrug-resistant TB. But particularly because a new drug was developed called bedaquiline, and then there was some repurposing of other antibiotics, such as a drug called linezolid. The new guidelines allow us to really emphasize an all-oral regimen for many patients, which is clearly much easier on them and easier on the health departments and cost less. So that's definitely an advance that has happened and is in the newer guidelines. And then after publication of those guidelines, the FDA approved another drug for drug-resistant tuberculosis called protaminid. And that was approved as part of a three-drug regimen, which can be used for 6 to 9 months. It's especially for very drug-resistant patients called extensively drug-resistant TB, or those who have MDR-TB that's very difficult to treat because of side effects or other problems. That's, you know, another advance, which I think is quite helpful for those patients who have that really extensive form of drug resistance. And, you know, a lot of this work in other research in drug resistance and programmatic work is being carried out by a number of U.S. agencies, particularly internationally, the U.S. Agency for International Development and National Institutes of Health, which are funding a lot of this critical research on drug-resistant TB.
So I understand the CDC's Division of Tuberculosis Elimination has 4 TB centers of excellence for training, education, and medical consultation that they're funding in a project between 2018 and 2022. Can you just tell me a little bit more and tell our audience a little bit more about the role these centers have with regard to TB elimination?
Certainly. Because TB has become less and less common, one of the concerns that we have had is that there just be fewer physicians and other medical providers, laboratory workers, public health workers who have actually seen a patient with TB or managed it and have the expertise to do that. So like with any other disease, the fewer cases there are in the country, the fewer people who have experience, and therefore it may, you know, if a case of TB occurs, it may be the first time that this medical provider has ever seen it. And so they really could benefit from having an ability to have consultation with experts and help them along with this. And that may be even true for some health departments, as some states are seeing fewer and fewer cases of TB. So the Centers of Excellence, as is in their name, really serve two functions. So one is training and education, courses, providing training courses, educational materials. Much of this is focused on health departments when new personnel come on board to a TB program, so that we can get them up to speed on how TB should be managed in the United States. And the second part is the medical consultation service. So there are 4 of these centers to cover 4 different regions. They're based in California, which covers the West. We have one in New Jersey for the Northeast, Texas for the middle of the country, and then Florida for the Southeast. And physicians who, whether they're managing a person with TB disease or latent TB, if they have questions, need assistance, they can reach these experts at these centers through telephone or email. And then they can get their questions answered and get guidance on the best way to manage their patients.
I know my training in TB is a number of years behind me. And I think it's very apropos that we have fewer and fewer physicians actually seeing and treating active TB. And I also noticed on the website, the CDC has what they call their core curriculum for TB for clinicians. Would you recommend this as a good starting point for physicians who want to freshen their skills in diagnosis and treatment of TB?
Yes. In fact, it was just recently updated, and so a newer version is going to be available later this month. So I think that's a really good place to start, because it just gives you kind of a general overview of everything. It's certainly not the only type of educational material we have. There are even more detailed online courses, and then there's actually a set, I think there are 9 self-study modules where basically much of the material in the core curriculum is broken up into different subject areas. So there'll be one on, you know, infection control, one on latent TB, one on TB disease, contact investigations, pretty much modules on everything. And so if people want to get to learn those areas in more detail, it's another really good source. And then you just mentioned that the Centers of Excellence, as I mentioned, they're responsible also for training courses and producing educational material. So there are many offerings that can also be obtained through those organizations.
Well, this has been a very good overview of treatment and diagnosis of TB. And since March is Tuberculosis Month because of World TB Day, I was wondering if there's any particular aspects that we didn't talk about that you want our listeners to take to heart as we celebrate World TB Day, March 2021.
Right. So World TB Day on March 24th, that commemorates when Dr. Robert Koch announced the discovery of the bacillus that causes TB. And that was, I believe, in 1882. So, I mean, we've known what's caused TB for well over 100 years. We've had antibiotics going back to the 1950s and 60s. And yet, globally, it is still, depending on how you count cases, the leading global infectious disease killer, despite the fact all we've known for so long. Right. So it is a major, major global problem. And, you know, in the setting of the COVID pandemic, I think globally, we've probably had some setbacks because COVID has, as it's interfered with medical care for many other conditions and diseases, not only so much in the United States, although there's been some issues even in the United States with people having delayed diagnoses because they didn't want to go into a healthcare setting because they were concerned about COVID, or because someone comes in with a cough and a fever, the first thing everyone thinking is COVID. And we know there's been individual anecdotes of people who've been tested many times for COVID and have negative tests and ultimately were found to have TB. So it's something, I think that the underlying message is, while the US is a low incidence country, and we definitely see a lot less than we did 100 years ago, it isn't gone. And so if people have the right constellation of symptoms and in a group that's high risk, don't forget about it, because delaying diagnosis not only hurts the patient because they're going to get sicker and make it more difficult to treat them, but during that time period, they could be spreading it to other people. So it's, I think, you know, for the United States, World TB Day is just a time to remember it's not gone. We still have work to do. And if people have TB and they're not diagnosed quickly and get on the right treatment and get the DOT to make sure they complete that treatment, they will get sick. They will spread it to other people and potentially can develop drug resistance.
I think those are two great messages. Certainly, we almost got through the whole interview without mentioning COVID, but I'm glad you did bring it up, because it does play a role and sometimes misstate in what the diagnosis is for somebody who may have TB. And the fact that it's still a big burden for the world is important for us to know. So again, I want to thank you for the time you took today, and we'll let you get back to your work at the CDC.
Well, thank you. It was a pleasure being with you.
Thanks a lot. Thanks again to Dr. Lebeau for his insights and for his exemplary leadership in the work of tuberculosis elimination. We're glad to have had the opportunity to reflect on this Awareness Day with an expert of his caliber. And thanks to all of you for joining our conversation this month as we raise awareness each March 24 on Tuberculosis Awareness Day. And amid our own struggle with COVID-19, it is important to recall the advances made against infectious threats, as it is not to lose sight on the challenges that remain. On the matters of both TB and COVID-19, we're making significant progress still. Be sure to subscribe to our Lungcast on your favorite podcast platform and register on both lung.org and hcplive.com for more respiratory health news and insights. For now, I'm Dr. Albert Rizzo, reminding you that if you can't breathe, nothing else matters. So just take it one breath at a time.